This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cara Levine survived the car accident uninjured 18 years ago, but her husband suffered a serious brain injury and was left with quadriplegia. Carol says when he was released from the hospital, she became a caregiver and not a wife. After 34 years of marriage and 17 years as a caregiver, Carol lost her husband last year. She recently wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine about life after his death. She had joined us on Fresh Air in 1999 to talk about family caregiving. We've invited her back to update her life and her thoughts about how to help family caregivers. Since 1996, she's directed the Families and Healthcare Project for the United Hospital Fund. She's launching a new project which will offer guides and materials for family caregivers. Earlier in her career, she was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship for her work in AIDS policy and ethics. Cara Levine, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've described yourself as having been widowed twice. What do you mean by that?
Well, the first time, Terry, I was widowed in a metaphorical sense when my husband was devastatingly injured in an automobile accident. And the second time I was widowed, in fact, when he died, which was January 1st, 2007. But it felt like being widowed twice.
What parts of him or of your relationship did you feel died after the accident?
Well, because he had a severe traumatic brain injury, the things that died after the accident were his wit, his ability to have a good sense of humor about almost anything that happened, his memory, his sociability, all of those things that made him the dear man I loved. And what was left was a very needy and very often angry man, which was part of what he was before. These things don't come out of nowhere, but it certainly was heightened, and sort of the loss of those other things made the balance so hard to deal with.
If you don't mind my asking, was the self that he became after the accident a person who you still loved?
I did love him, even in that state. It was hard to deal with, but I responded to his need. I saw his deep love for our children, our grandchildren, even though he could not really express it in the way he would have. And love never died. It just got moved over into a different part of my life. And I had to find a new way to express my love for him, which was through caring for him, which I had never anticipated would be the case.
What were some of the needs that you had to take care of?
I had to take care of everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. Now, I did not provide all of the direct hands-on care. He was essentially quadriplegic in addition to the traumatic brain injury. So I did have home care aides with him during the day when I was at work. But I was the night nurse, as I called myself. So I was responsible for organizing the home care, for paying them, for making sure that all of his needs were met. I became his advocate and his spokesperson, which he had been quite able to do that for himself before, and I had never seen myself in that role. And I did have to learn to manage all of that. It was an all-inclusive and very intense relationship.
I know people who have complained bitterly about how difficult life is taking care of their spouse or their parent, and how there's no time for the things they want to do, and their routine is totally revolving around the sick person. And then after the sick person dies, the person who had been the resentful caregiver feels lost. Feels lost and like, what am I supposed to do now?
I think if you become that kind of intensely involved caregiver, there's no way not to resent some of it. If anyone who says it's a total joy every minute of the day, I think is deluding themselves or deluding you. I kept working, and I believe that working saved my life, basically. Many people would say, well, why are you still working? Well, I had to earn money, one, but I also had to have a life. And I think that is what saved me from the kind of despair that many caregivers fall into.
I remember the previous time when we talked, and this was in the late 90s, you were saying that when your husband got out of the hospital and he was helpless and they were just saying, take him home and deal with it.
Right.
You were basically told that if you wanted to qualify for home health care, that you basically had to quit your job.
Yes.
I mean, for funding for home health care. You had to quit your job, stay home, and do your best to become poor so that you'd qualify. And
right.
that you thought that that was a ridiculous way of doing things. So why would you have had to quit your job, and why did you refuse to do it?
Well, Medicaid, the only publicly funded home care, and it's not 24-hour care mostly, is only available to people who are indigent, and that means really poor. And if you are married to someone, not just living with, but married, that your income counts as the spouse's income. And so the only way I, as a wife, could have been able to have him eligible was to not earn anything and to become eligible for Medicaid, where we would really not even have the level of services that he needed. And I just thought that was not fair. And I was willing to pay my share. I was willing to do something reasonable in terms of, I didn't expect the government to pay for all of it, but I certainly would have wanted a more equitable arrangement. And the advice I was given was both, you know, quit your job, stay home, spend down is the term, get eligible, or divorce him, and then it won't count. But that would have been fraud. And so I said, I don't like either option A or option B. I like option C, which is I continue to work, and I provide the home care for him.
Were you able to at least deduct the home health care expenses?
Some
of
it, yes. Some of it you can deduct. Not all of it, but some. And let me just say, it's not a winning proposition here. And it's very expensive, and it's getting more expensive. And also, I think even now, and this is, you know, 17, 18 years after I started, the workforce is smaller. It's very hard to find competent people to do this job. So that's one of the issues that I think has arisen in the time since we spoke. It's not just your willingness to pay for it. It's finding people who are willing to do the job.
Carol, your husband survived his accident for 17 years.
Yes.
For 17 years, he lived with a traumatic brain injury and as a quadriplegic. For most of those 17 years, your professional issue was home health care policy. I mean, you've been directing for a long time now the Families and Healthcare Project of the United Hospital Fund. What would you like to see done as somebody who's been advocating policies on this front for many years? If you could write the policies yourself, what would you be writing?
Oh, that would be nice. I would first start with changing the so-called unit of care in Medicare and Medicaid from an individual to a family unit. This is the way hospice is organized, and this is the way palliative care is organized. Understanding that a patient or a beneficiary of these regulatory benefits does not exist in a vacuum, and that you have to take account of the family member who is providing most of the care. That means an assessment not just of the patient but of the family caregiver. Is this person able to do this job? Nobody ever asked me, could I do it? What parts of it could I do? What parts of it couldn't I do?
And for example, a part you couldn't do is like lift him.
Right. The parts I couldn't do were the heavy duty, literally the heavy lifting and the constant personal care that he required. I could do many of the things, but I couldn't do them all. Nobody ever asked, do you have any health problems that may interfere with your being able to do this? Do you have other people you're caring for? Do you have a job? I mean, those are things that were sort of basic questions were never asked. It was just assumed that either I would do it or I would find somebody else to do it. And I think caregiver assessment is becoming more common, but it's usually now in the outpatient setting where a caregiver comes in with so much stress and so much burden that they are really paralyzed and unable to go forward. We've done studies that show even when there is formal home care in the home, which is usually a very short period, the family members are providing 3/4 of the care anyway. So they need to be involved. They need to be helped to find ways to do the job in their own way. I remember that, you know, when the few times I had a formal home services after an operation or something like that, the nurse would say things like, well, you have to turn him every 2 hours. Well, that's not possible. You know, no way. It's going to happen. So we have to figure out a way to prevent bed sores without having someone turn him every 2 hours.
Two reasons why that couldn't happen. One is that you were going to be at work, and the other is you weren't strong enough to do it.
I wasn't strong enough to do it, and he wouldn't tolerate it. Those were three reasons why it wouldn't work. So he didn't like that moving around. So, you know, this was not good advice. It's standard nursing advice, but it didn't work. So we had to find another way.
Which was hiring somebody, huh?
Which was partly was hiring somebody, but then I was there at home at night. So I had to find ways to make sure that his skin was intact. I could look at that. I could make sure that there were lotions and all of those other things. And I would say that I'm pretty proud. Over the 17 years he was at home, he never had a skin breakdown. And, you know, that's very rare. But it was just due to constant monitoring. And that was, you know, wasn't due to turning him every 2 hours.
Anything else you'd like to change in the system?
Well, I would certainly like to change the funding so that long-term care is not only going to nursing homes, but is really going to support families and patients in the community. Right now, there's still an imbalance in the institutional bias of Medicare, Medicaid, and to provide some sort of financial support for family caregivers in the middle. Because in the end, it saves the system money if the patient stays at home. So why not help the family do that in a way that doesn't force them into poverty and doesn't lose the productive contributions of so many family caregivers?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kara Levine. She directs the Families and Healthcare Project of the United Hospital Fund. She's a former MacArthur Fellow. And for 17 years, she took care of her husband at home after he was very seriously injured in a car accident. He had traumatic brain injury and was a quadriplegic after the accident. He died in 2007. Carol, during the 17 years that your husband was transformed and living at home and you were taking care of him, did you ever talk to him about his death, about what he wanted? I mean, what his medical wishes were, how much intervention he wanted, that kind of thing?
Yes. In fact, not only did I talk to him, he talked to me. He would bring this up many, many times and say, he would say in a very serious way, I want to talk about something. I'd say, okay, what is it? I want to talk about dying. I said, okay, what do you want to talk about here? And he was very clear because he had had so many hospitalizations and was so unwilling to undergo any kind of real intervention that he did not want to be hospitalized. He did not want anything feeding tubes or any of those things. So he also talked to me about his funeral or his memorial service, and he was very clear about that. And I felt he mentioned the people he wanted to speak, and I was able to do that and able to get those people. And in his memorial service, I felt as though he were there because this was what he wanted. And so it was very, of course it was sad. It was very sad because he actually died very suddenly. But it was gratifying to hear people talk about him in the way that he knew they would.
Did you ever talk about whether he ever wished he had died instead of surviving with such a compromised mental and physical state?
No, I think my husband had a very realistic outlook on life, very pragmatic. He never wished that he had died. He wished often that it hadn't happened, but that he did try to to find the enjoyment that he could. This did not mean he was happy all the time. He certainly was not. But that the things that made him happy did please him a lot. And those were, as I said, children and grandchildren, watching sports on television. He was a major Giants fan. And having readers come and read to him, and I think that was one of the wonderful things that I was able to do for him, was to hire underemployed actors in New York, and they would come for 2 hours a day and read to him or talk to him and give him that connection with to the outside world that was not me and was not the home care aide, but was something else. And so he took pleasure in little things, but then it was against a background of sadness. So I think he tried to find the best ways that he could to cope, and didn't work all the time. But when it did, he was okay.
I know underemployed actors are not hard to find in New York, but how did you find the people who would come and read to your husband?
Well, I had a first group from the Tisch School of the Arts students, and then went to another setting where a lot of actors live and put up a sign. And, you know, from then one led to the other. And there were, you know, a core group who stayed with him for many years, actually. And they liked it because it was flexible for them. And if they had an audition, it worked out for everyone.
How did your husband die?
He died suddenly of congestive heart failure. And this is something he had experienced before. But in each of those cases, meaning the home care aide and I, had been able to, with the doctor, been able to overcome. And so there were a certain number of techniques that we used. And then this one time on New Year's Eve, it just came very suddenly, very severely, and I was alone with him. And within a few hours, he was dead. So he had had a very good weekend, and it was just a shock. It sounds ironic to say after all these years, but I never expected it to be that way. And so it was as big a shock as if it had happened, you know, without any preparation. It was very traumatic for me and for my family.
During the 17 years that you took care of your husband at home, I'm sure you wondered sometimes what it was going to be like when you came out the other end of that experience. Your husband died a year and a half ago. What's surprising you most about life without him?
How much I miss him and how much I miss the person he was. I hadn't really been able to grieve the loss of that person. And so
the loss of the person he was after the accident.
Exactly. I had become so close to the person he became that I had lost touch with the person he was. And so that's really difficult.
Is his absence allowing you now to become more in touch with the person he was before the accident?
Yes, it is. And I find myself remembering things that I had totally forgotten. And that's very gratifying. And one of the nice things about the Times essay was that many people who knew him many years ago have called me. And so that reminds me of this really wonderful person. But it's also given me a chance to be myself again, which is a good thing.
Kara Levine, thanks so much for talking with us, and all best to you.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Kara Levine is the director of the United Hospital Fund's Families and Healthcare Project. She's preparing to launch a new project, The Next Step in Care, which will offer guides and materials for family caregivers.